Today is Tuesday, November 7th. We're going to be working on urinary system anatomy today. Okay, page 103 starts the urinary system. So why don't we start with the system overview? We'll talk first about the organs that make up this system. And you'll notice in this picture there's not a whole lot going on with the urinary system. There's two kidneys. There are two tubes called ureters that connect the kidneys to the bladder. And we should specify and say urinary bladder so as to avoid confusion with another bladder, the gallbladder, right? So we do try to specify when we're in this chapter that we're talking urinary bladder. And then, of course, there's the urethra that transports urine to the outside of the body. Now, the main organs for this system are the kidneys. They're the ones that perform filtration of our blood. So let's hit the five functions there on the top of page 103 for this system. You probably knew way before you ever stepped foot in this class that a number one job of the kidneys is to remove waste products from the bloodstream. Do you know what some of those waste products are? Let's see, some waste products that might be removed, maybe some acids that you no longer need, maybe urea and uric acid that are breakdown products of, say, proteins and nucleic acids. So there are things like that that can become toxic if they stay in the bloodstream. So our kidney's job is to help remove those waste products and dump those toxins into the urine. Second major job there is to regulate the volume and composition of the blood. Thinking way back to our discussion of hormones, can you tell me, say, two hormones that help to regulate blood volume? ADH, good.
Aldosterone.
Yeah, so we've got two really good ones there that help maintain blood volume. We'll also learn there for number three that the hormone that helps maintain blood pH is actually aldosterone. You know, aldosterone is incredibly important. It does a number of different things for our kidneys, and so it also plays a role in helping us maintain blood pH. We also know the kidneys help us maintain blood pressure. We regulate blood volume, that leads to the regulation of pressure. And then finally, their EPO with number five helps us make new red blood cells. Do you remember the stimulus for turning on EPO? Low blood oxygen, good. So, a couple of things there we've talked about before, but we're going to really go into the details of the kidney and how it works today. All right, so in terms of kidney external anatomy, you'll notice on your sheet there's a number of things that surround the outside surface of our kidneys. You'll notice that there's an adrenal gland sitting on the tops of our kidneys. Sometimes they're called suprarenal since they're sitting on the superior side of the kidneys. By the way, you'll notice that these kidneys do not sit at the same level. The right kidney actually sits a little bit lower. What organ is pushing it out of the way?
Liver.
Yep, so the liver pushes that right kidney to sit a little bit lower. In terms of wrappings around the kidneys, you'll notice that we've got a fibrous capsule, a fat capsule, and then we've got fascia that help to hold the kidneys in place. And it's important to appreciate that there's no muscle, there's no bone that helps to anchor the kidneys to the back part of our body wall. All that anchors them to the back of your body is just these fat pads and these fascia layers. So it's important to appreciate that if you are jarred or hit across the lower ribs where these kidneys are sitting, you can actually jar these organs loose and they can prolapse or slide down the back of your body wall. The important part now is to assume that if you bend these ureters coming away from the kidneys, then what can no longer escape the kidneys?
Urine,
yeah. So we can see fluid and urine back up in the kidneys if those tubes become kinked or bent. And of course, that can lead to problems like swelling in the kidneys when the urine backs up. So, yeah, that's all that holds our kidneys in place.
Can that happen?
I'm not sure. I've heard mostly being hit. like a car accident or whatnot that hits a person along the back here that would cause them to slide down. Yeah, I think babies can push all that out of the way, so,
oh my God.
Yeah, push everything in the wrong direction, yeah.
They can break ribs too.
Yeah, they sure can, mm-hmm. Yep. Kick you and everything else.
Oh yeah, broke my ribs.
Really?
Yeah, I had twins.
Oh wow, I can imagine with twins fighting for space, yeah.
That's
what's
happening.
Ooh. I had a terrible 21.
Yeah.
My rib was broke. I told him it was
I should also tell you that the kidneys are retroperitoneal. That means they're sitting behind the peritoneum. The peritoneum, we know, covers the digestive organs, but the kidneys are kind of behind the curtain, so to speak. So they're considered to be retroperitoneal. They're retro. So let's talk about the regions of the kidney. You can't see them from this outer view, but we can cut open the kidney and look inside. We can see only from the outside view the adrenal gland on the top and the hilum or hilus sitting here in the middle where the ureter and adrenal or other renal artery and vein come and go from the kidney. But when you cut into the kidney along the lymph section, you're going to find that there are three sections or regions revealed. And these are listed here in order from most superficial to deep. Okay, cortex, medulla or medulla, and then pelvis. These are listed here from superficial to deep. The outermost region is your cortex, and if you're looking at this thing like a piece of fruit, imagine that this was an apple, for instance. If you were to peel off the skin of the apple, you'd be taking off this renal capsule, kind of a brown color on the outside. Underneath, you would have the flesh, and that would be the renal cortex. That is the most superficial region. And the cortex also forms these renal columns. Those columns dive between those renal pyramids and separate them from one another. So, in fact, the outermost layer, the cortex, also creates these columns in between. Okay, and then if you were to think about the seeds inside of an apple, these little renal pyramids right through here are kind of like the seeds of the apple, and they form another layer that we call the renal medulla or medulla. And then finally, the innermost portion of your kidney is kind of like the core of an apple, and that is what we think of as our renal pelvis. This is the portion that gathers urine before that urine travels on down the ureter. So just from superficial to deep, we have the cortex, which includes the columns. We have the pyramids found in the renal medulla region. And then we have the pelvis, which is a basin-like area collecting urine before the urine travels down the ureter. Okay. So when we talk about urine flow from the kidney, urine actually drips from the tips of these renal pyramids. They drip first into a little tiny region right around the tip. That region is called a minor calyx. Okay, so when urine drips from the tips of the renal pyramids, that urine drips first into an area called the minor calyx. When you've got a couple of minor calyces coming together, they form what's called a major calyx. And the majors drain into the renal pelvis. So if you've got to think about baseball, you play for the minor leagues, and you go to the major leagues, and then you're in the renal pelvis. So that's kind of the flow pattern of getting urine out of the kidney. So it drips from the tips of the renal pyramids into the minor calyx. The minor calyces join to form majors. And then we're in the renal pelvis, down the ureter. What's the next stop? Urinary bladder. And then, of course, we hold it there until we release it through a tube called urethra. Yep. So that's part of a flow path that we'll pick up. That is the pathway of urine from the kidney to the outside of the body. So we'll hang on to that one. You may have had one of these little models in lab to look at for the kidneys, and the cool thing about them is they've got two little nephrons painted on there. It looks almost like somebody had fun with a whiteout pen and did some doodling, but those things right there are nephrons. And each of our kidneys has about a million nephrons. These are the structural and functional units of your kidneys. Okay? These are the structural and functional units of your kidneys. We know that people can live with only one functional kidney, and if that's the case, then the existing kidney may add extra nephrons to handle the filtration process and the blood flow coming through. Otherwise, you know, if you've got one healthy kidney, it's going to have to do the job that the two used to handle. So this is a nephron. This, in reality, does not exist straight out like you see on the piece of paper. It, in reality, gives itself a hug. So it coils up on itself and kind of wraps around and gives itself a hug. So we'll talk more about that because it plays a role in the naming of the structures here. Let's talk about the two major parts of your nephron. The first major part is called the renal corpuscle. The renal corpuscle includes the glomerulus and a capsule that we're going to call either Bowman's capsule or glomerular capsule. Okay. So when we're looking for the glomerulus, we're looking for a knot of capillaries that are inside the nephron, and this set of capillaries is sitting here, surrounded by a capsule, and that capsule is the Bowman's capsule or glomerular capsule. So if we were to circle those two items, we would now be circling that renal corpuscle. Tube here is called a renal tubule, and this tubule has a PCT, which stands for proximal convoluted tubule, and the reason it's called proximal is it's close to your renal corpuscle. Okay, so we can just call it PCT for short. That stands for proximal convoluted tubule, and the word proximal means close to, so it's close to your renal corpuscle. The next thing we've got is a hairpin curve. It's called the loop, and you can either call it the loop of Henle, which is an older name for it. The more modern name is nephron loop. So this loop that travels down like a hairpin curve, that's our nephron loop. And finally, you get a good distance away from your glomerular capsule and your renal corpuscle. So the tubing that's farthest away from your corpuscle is called the DCT. What does the D stand for?
Distal.
Distal. Good. So that DCT is farthest away from your renal corpuscle. And eventually what you end up doing is dumping a bunch of DCT tubes into a collecting duct or a collecting tube. And so this structure here is a collecting duct or tube, and these are DCTs draining into that tube. If you've made it as far as the collecting duct, mostly what you have is waste products that are going to form urine. And the pointed portion of this tube is going to actually aim at one of those renal pyramid tips. So you may have noticed in lab that on those bigger models, those renal pyramids look like they had a striped appearance, look like they had a bunch of lines drawn toward the tip. And those are all representing those collecting ducts dumping their urine toward the tip of the renal pyramid. So it kind of helps to appreciate that that's how we get the urine out of the kidney. We collect those ducts in those renal pyramids. good so far? Any questions so far? Okay, now if you were to imagine taking this picture of the nephron and rolling it up in a tube and letting it give itself a hug, that's in reality how it sits inside the kidney. So when you appreciate that this is not sitting out as a flat structure, but rather kind of coiled up giving itself a hug, it then makes sense why the DCT is snug up against the renal capsule and renal corpuscle there. So right here is the DCT, and the DCT is coiled back around. This is the glomerular capillaries, and this is the Bowman's capsule surrounding it. We have an afferent arteriole bringing blood into the glomerular capillaries, and we've got an efferent one draining the blood away. Okay, so when we appreciate that the nephron gives itself a hug, then it's like, okay, now I see why the DCT is butting up against that glomerular capsule and the blood network that drains and feeds into that area. So the reason I want to point this out is because we're looking for a fancy set of cells called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. Yeah. Notice that one on your worksheet, and you can call it the JGA for short. Okay, juxtaglomerular apparatus, you can call it JGA for short. Okay, so let's kind of think big picture here. The job of the kidney is to filter blood, and in order to filter blood, you have to have high hydrostatic pressure to push the fluids out of the capillaries. That story should sound familiar, right? Way back when we talked about vessels, the hydrostatic pressure pushed the fluids out. Hydrostatic pressure is the same thing as blood pressure. So if you've got low blood pressure, you're not going to be pushing very hard to get those items to be filtered out of your bloodstream. So these JGA cells sit right here between the afferent and efferent arterioles, right here in this triangular region. And when blood's coming in through the afferent arteriole to feed that glomerular capillary bed, if the pressure's not high enough, those JGA cells say, hey, you know, your push, your hydrostatic pressure is not going to be great enough to allow us to do filtration. And so what we need to do is increase blood pressure. How do you increase blood pressure? How do you
increase?
Aldosterone, good. All right, so here's what we do. When you've got low blood pressure coming in through that afferent arteriole, the JGA cells sitting in that little triangular region are monitoring blood pressure. If your blood pressure is too low to allow for filtration, then those JGA cells turn on renin. Yep. And that renin goes to your liver, and the liver makes angiotensin 1, and we convert angiotensin 1 to 2. And of course, this comes full circle. We come back to the kidneys, well, the adrenal glands to be specific, and we tell the adrenal glands to release a hormone. Which hormone?
Aldosterone.
Yeah, aldosterone. Aldosterone comes to the DCT, and it says, hey, DCT, don't let go of that fluid or that sodium. Keep it, and so we retain both salt and water by reabsorbing it back into the bloodstream. Okay, so that is going to help us increase blood volume and blood pressure. So basically, the kidneys send a message to themselves to retain more water and more salt. So let me tell you a little bit more about this. We've been here before, right? This looks familiar. Okay, so the catch is that the renin is released by the JGA cells. And renin is what tells the liver to make angiotensin 1. You'll notice that angiotensin 1 is then converted into angiotensin 2 using what enzyme? ACE, good. And that ACE enzyme is going to help us make a more powerful vasoconstrictor. Okay? So angiotensin 2 will actually constrict your vessels. And if I can flip back for a moment, I'll show you which one in particular gets constricted. Good, okay. So angiotensin 2 will actually constrict the efferent arteriole. This is our exit route, okay? So if you constrict the exit flow and don't let the blood leave the glomerulus, the blood in the glomerulus will back up and pressure will increase. Yeah. So that is one way for us to help maintain filtration, even if we have low blood pressure. So angiotensin II is a potent vasoconstrictor. It constricts blood vessels, especially the efferent arteriole, leading out of that glomerular capillary bed. Okay? So if you do that, that helps us to maintain filtration. And in the meantime, angiotensin II comes to your adrenal gland, and your adrenal gland releases aldosterone. What does aldosterone make you keep? What does aldosterone make you keep?
Sodium.
Yep. And what does ADH make you keep?
Water.
Yep. So those two come as a tag team to your DCT, and they reabsorb more sodium and more water. And what impact will that have on your blood volume?
Increase
it. Yep. So we've solved our problem by actually telling the kidneys to keep more salt and more water. Okay, so this is a good one to know in terms of the layout. We've been here before. All we've done is add a couple of more new details to the list. Now we know that renin is made by what set of cells in the kidney?
JGA,
good. And we now, of course, appreciate that this mechanism will turn on not only aldosterone, but also ADH. So we kind of have just a more holistic appreciation for how this works now that we finally reach the urinary system. Anybody else need to snap a picture? Good to go. Anyone else? Okay. Just a little bit on the bottom of this page about cortical nephrons and juxtamedullary nephrons. Most of our nephrons are what are considered to be cortical in nature. That word should ring a bell. These are in the renal cortex, or the outermost portion of your kidney. The juxtamedullaries are not as common, but they are found down in the deeper portions of your kidney, and they sit hooked partly across the transition between the cortex and the medulla. Okay, so when you look at this picture, you'll see that the cortical nephrons are sitting outside, mostly outside in that renal cortex region. The juxtamedullaries do sit across the junction between cortex and medulla. And one thing to notice about them is to appreciate the lengths of their nephron loops. So take a look at the cortex nephron loop, very short, and compare that to the much longer juxtamedullary nephron loop. The length of that loop is going to drive how much fluid can be reabsorbed from those nephrons back into the bloodstream. So the longer the nephron loop, the more opportunity your kidneys have to reabsorb fluids. The shorter the loop, the less time you have to reabsorb fluids. Now, appreciating that, which one of these nephrons do you think will make more dilute, light-colored urine?
Longer.
Shorter, yeah. Why the shorter one? Less time. Yep. If you've got a short pipe, you have less time to absorb fluids. This really long pipe means you've got a lot of time to absorb fluids, and those longer nephron loops actually give us a more concentrated dark yellow urine. So in terms of blood flow we're looking at here, your body can shift and use these to maintain concentration of the bloodstream and also to maintain how much solutes are being pumped out into the urine. Okay, so let's talk about blood supply through the kidney. This is page 105. And by the way, this is tracing number one on the bottom of page 105. Okay, so blood flow here is actually tracing number one. That's actually one of four that you could potentially answer, and they'll all be on your essays for the test next time. So you can pick. So the thing to appreciate here is there's five arteries coming into the kidney. There's actually only four veins leaving. Okay, if you're taking pictures, here's the second half of the flow. Okay, so let's talk through this using a picture. Just want to put a disclaimer out there that you can go to the library, go to the internet, pull any resource, and they will most likely give you a different flow pattern for blood flow through the kidney. That's incredibly frustrating because, you know, we want something to be right and we want it to be consistent. But because the kidneys are formed and reabsorbed at least three times during your fetal development period, there seems to be an inconsistency with the way our blood vessels develop in the kidneys. So this particular flow pattern that we're doing is the one used by our textbook, but you can go pull any other A&P textbook and most likely get a slightly different blood flow through the kidney. So the renal artery is usually the starting point. That's in agreement among most textbooks and most resources. And that's going to bring a blood supply right off the aorta into the kidney. It immediately branches in the kidney into around five different segmental arteries. These segmental arteries are then going to branch again, and these are now called what? Interlobar arteries. Good. So if you follow where we're going, watch how these interlobar arteries travel between your renal pyramids. Okay, all of them do. All of these interlobars travel between your renal pyramids. And then the interlobar arteries branch again into arcuate. Good. And now notice the arcuate arteries are sitting at the bases of the pyramids. There they are. Okay? And these arcuate arteries are going to actually give rise to a last set of arteries. These are called two names. Good. Cortical radii or interlobular. Okay, so your choice. I do caution you that if you do use interlobular, you keep in mind that there is already a set of interlobar arteries. It's easy to get confused there with the spelling. So cortical radiate may be an easier one to use. They do, in fact, radiate around the cortex all the way around your kidney here. Okay? And when we are looking at the cortical radiate arteries, we then need to switch to a different picture. Here they are at the cortex of your kidney. And they give rise to a set of afferent arterioles. Those afferent arterioles feed blood into a capillary bed here. And that capillary bed is called the glomerulus. You can also call them glomerular capillaries. And now we're finally in the region of a nephron. All right, so then if we're taking a blood cell, for instance, they're not filtered. They will continue riding along in the bloodstream. They exit the glomerulus by way of efferent or efferent arterioles. I do want to mention this is kind of an oddball flow pattern. Everything we've learned up to this point has been arteries, arterioles, capillaries, venules, and veins. But not here. We've actually got arteries to arterioles to capillaries, back to an arteriole, back to capillaries, and then eventually you get back to the venule and the vein setup. So it's a little odd in terms of our flow pattern. Okay. It's all about pressure. Yep, exactly right. Good. Where do we go after those efferent arterioles? Peritubular capillaries. Good. And you'll notice they wrap around your nephron, and they drain into a venule, and that venule will now link us back up with the exit route for the veins. So the venule really doesn't have a specific name. It's just a venule that links you up to the interlobular or cortical radiate vein. And from there, we're on our way back out. Let's go back to our big picture. were from the cortical radiate veins to an arcuate vein. Where next? Interlobar vein, and then the renal vein. And we're actually missing a step for the venous pathway that we had in the arterial flow. What step is that? Segmental, right. So just to make the point once again, there are 5 arteries leading in, only 4 veins leaving. Just keep in mind there's no segmental vein on the way out. So I know you guys have some of these in lab to look at. I know you have the models to look at. Let me just give you a helpful hint. These arcuate arteries and veins are always going to sit horizontal on those models. And that's because they're sitting at the base of the pyramid, and the cortical radiate artery and vein are going to sit perpendicular. So arcuate's going to sit horizontal, and cortical radiates are going to run upward. They're going to run vertical on those models. And then branching off those cortical radiates are the afferent arterioles, glomerulus, and efferent arterioles. So just a helpful hint there so that kind of reduces the confusion in lab. All right, how you doing with blood flow? You've been here, done this, right? Okay. Any questions on it? So let me tell you a little bit about the job of the kidney in terms of filtering, reabsorbing, and secreting. One of the things that we need to appreciate is that we've got a job of cleaning the blood, and that filtration process begins over on page 106. So filtration does occur in the glomerular capillaries. This is a way for us to take items out of our bloodstream and get rid of the waste products that we no longer wish to keep. Now, there's going to be a lot of good stuff in this filtrate that we want to reclaim and put back in the bloodstream, but we'll take care of that in a second step called reabsorption. You'll notice some things that filtrate includes are blood plasma and the dissolved substances in your bloodstream. So this includes electrolytes. It includes glucose, amino acids. It also includes waste products that we do not intend to keep. Do notice what we're not looking to filter. We do not aim to filter things like blood cells, that includes red, white, and platelets, and we don't aim to filter blood proteins. The issue with these, they're too large to be filtered, so therefore we're not going to take them out of the bloodstream because, in fact, there would be no way to reclaim them back. Okay, so I've seen filtration described like this. If you cook spaghetti at home or any kind of pasta, you may get done cooking and you may strain your pasta and the water through a colander. So if the colander has holes that are big enough for the fluids to pass through, but not big enough for the spaghetti, then of course when you pour your spaghetti in, you keep your spaghetti noodles and all the water and the solutes go floating down through the sink. That's the concept that we expect to see here with our glomerular capillaries. We want the small stuff to be filtered out, but the bigger stuff, like blood cells and proteins, we don't necessarily want to lose. So the holes, the filtration membrane holes, are not going to let the big stuff pass through and be filtered. All right, so let me show you what's actually happening with filtration. This picture illustrates net filtration pressure, something we've been at before. Okay, way back when we studied blood vessels, we talked about 2 battling pressures. What were those 2 pressures? Hydrostatic and osmotic. Do you remember which of these pressures is the pushy pressure?
Hydrostatic,
yeah. And way back when we studied this, do you remember which pressure was the winner at the arterial end of the capillary?
Hydrostatic.
Hydrostatic, yeah. Hydrostatic was the winner.
I know I didn't have you guys learn the numbers, but way back then the hydrostatic pressure was around 35 millimeters mercury and the osmotic was around 26. Here you'll notice that the hydrostatic is actually pretty high. It's around 55 millimeters mercury, okay? And that's quite a bit higher for a very important reason. We are looking to do filtration and we are not interested in reabsorbing right now. So this time they say the osmotic pressure is around 30. Now if this was the only story we had to tell, you would say that hydrostatic pressure was your winner. It's higher than your osmotic pressure, and it's going to push the fluids out of the glomerular capillaries, and those fluids get captured by your Bowman's capsule. Now, there's one more complicating factor here, and you'll notice there's a third pressure called capsular hydrostatic pressure. So when you get fluids filtered out of the capillaries in the glomerulus, those fluids are captured by that Bowman's capsule. We know that fluid creates hydrostatic pressure. Is hydrostatic pressure the pushy pressure or the pulling pressure?
Push.
Push, yeah. And so this capsular hydrostatic pressure is actually fluid sitting out here in this space, and it's pushing. It's pushing back into those capillaries, and so it's actually working against the process of filtration. So I just want to make a note here that this hydrostatic pressure is pushing back into the glomerulus. And you'll notice this value is around 15 millimeters mercury. Arterial end of the capillary is 10 millimeters mercury, and so is the pressure inside the glomerulus. 10 is your net filtration pressure. And so we can appreciate what's going on. We've got two pressures here that are working against our hydrostatic pressure. We've got osmotic pressure and that capsular hydrostatic pressure that's working against the ability to filter. Coming full circle, if you don't have a net filtration pressure in your kidneys of around 10 millimeters mercury, what chemical does your JGA release? Renin.
Renin.
Oh. And then renin carries to the liver, and the liver now releases? Angiotensin 1.
ACE
converts it to angiotensin 2. Then you've got aldosterone to ADH. Good. And angiotensin 2 comes back to your glomerular capillaries and squeezes the efferent arteriole. That makes it harder for blood to escape your glomerulus, and that will help to maintain a higher hydrostatic pressure. So all of this can lead to turning on aldosterone if you don't have a high enough net filtration pressure. Okay? So we're kind of tying things together here that we've studied before. Let's take this a step further and go back to your worksheet there. You'll notice down below the picture there's something called a glomerular filtration rate. And this is based on your net filtration pressure of about 10 millimeters mercury of
of push. So the rate at which we can filter items out of our bloodstream is about 120 milliliters of blood plasma per minute. 120 to 125, I've seen it differently in textbooks, so around 120 to 125. You don't have to worry about the math there, but I thought you might be interested in knowing that over, say, a 24-hour period of time, you can filter, say, about 180 liters of blood plasma per day. That's an incredible amount of fluid and an incredible amount of efficiency that your kidneys have. I do want to mention that over a lifetime that your glomerular filtration rate drops, so that by the time you're in your 70s, your glomerular filtration rate will be in your 70s. By the time you're in your 80s, it drops to the 60s. So we do not expect to see a glomerular filtration rate of 120 to 125 throughout your entire lifetime. It seems to drop by a value of about 10 per decade of life. So when you're in your 30s, you know, it may have dropped down to around 100. When you're in your 40s, it's dropped into the 90s and so forth. So, you know, we do expect to see a decline in this filtration rate. Your kidneys do lose efficiency over your lifetime. All right, so you want to highlight these numbers. NFP, or net filtration pressure, is 10, and your glomerular filtration rate is around 120 to 125 milliliters per minute. By the way, I'll do attendance today on who picked up test instead of passing around the sign-in sheet. Okay, so in terms of wanting to know how efficient your kidneys are, they will base your glomerular filtration rate on a creatinine test. Creatinine is a waste product of metabolism, and normally it should be removed by the kidneys, should be filtered to some extent, not reabsorbed, and secreted. So we're looking at it not being in the bloodstream after the blood has traveled through your kidneys. If you have high levels of creatinine in your bloodstream, what does that tell us about your kidneys' efficiency?
Not filtering how it should.
Yeah, not filtering how it should. Right, so if we consistently see high levels of creatinine, that's going to actually give us a low calculation for the glomerular filtration rate. So some things that are used for renal clearance tests are chemicals like inulin. It's a polysaccharide that's usually filtered and not reabsorbed. Creatinine is another common item used to detect renal clearance. How do you think dehydration would influence your renal clearance? Concentrated, yeah. So items that normally should be filtered and removed may not be because you're dehydrated. So your hydration status will also influence your glomerular filtration rate and your ability to clear these toxins or waste products out of your bloodstream. So yeah, they normally don't do a minute's time, that's pretty quick. They'll usually do like over a certain period, 6 hours, 12 hours, 24, so forth, to see how efficiently the kidneys are removing these items. All right, so let's take a look at page 107. We've got tubular reabsorption there. So let's review. When we're filtering items out of the bloodstream, we're taking small stuff in your blood plasma. We're not removing and filtering items that are big, like what?
Blood cells, platelets.
Yeah, blood cells, platelets, proteins, they're all too big to filter. So some of the tiny stuff we're taking are electrolytes, glucose, amino acids, water, of course, but none of the big stuff, because if you do filter it, it's gone. It's going to be leaving your body in the urine. So let's take, say a molecule of glucose, for instance. That molecule of glucose is riding along in your arteries. It travels through the afferent arteriole, and it's small enough so it gets filtered out by the filtration membrane inside your glomerulus. That Bowman's capsule will capture the glucose, and the glucose travels over here into your PCT.
we now have an opportunity to start reabsorbing items back into the bloodstream. And we specifically call this tubular reabsorption because we're talking about the reabsorption in the tubules of your kidneys. So if I take this efferent arteriole here and extend it a little bit further, it actually wraps around your nephron and it forms a set of capillaries. What are the capillaries that wrap your nephron? Peritubular, good. So the item like glucose that you may want to keep is then moved from your proximal convoluted tubule back into your peritubular capillaries. A lot of this is simply based on diffusion. Sometimes it's facilitated diffusion or active transport, but we're looking at reclaiming items that we need back into the bloodstream in this tubule system. So about 99% of what we filter, we're going to end up reclaiming. Only 1% of what is filtered ends up actually becoming urine. That tells me the kidneys are pretty darn efficient at what they do. 99% of what we're filtering ends up getting reclaimed and reabsorbed into the bloodstream. So let's take reabsorption here in the PCT. Let's make a note that reabsorption means that we're moving these wanted items back into the bloodstream. We want to reclaim them. So your body's going to move them from the PCT back into that peritubular capillary network that surrounds your nephron tube. So pretty much everything on this list, sodium, glucose, chlorine, bicarbonates, water, and amino acids, you can probably think of a very important reason to have them back. You know, glucose makes ATP, okay? Chlorine, for instance, is a big buddy of sodium. Those are gonna help us maintain hydration. They're gonna help us with things like, chlorine makes hydrochloric acid. Sodium is found in your interstitial fluids. So you can go through the list and find a pretty good reason to keep every single one of these items that we're going to reabsorb. I should tell you that sodium is kind of the ringleader here. It's going to be coupled with the reabsorption of glucose, chlorine, bicarbonates. Okay? So that means if you take sodium back into your bloodstream, glucose, chlorine, and bicarbonates will all come along. So it's kind of like the ringleader. It drives the reabsorption of those other molecules. So sodium is coupled with glucose, chlorine, bicarbonate ions. We automatically take back around 60 to 70% of the chlorine, or the sodium rather, in our PCT, and that automatically drives the amount of glucose we can reabsorb and the amount of bicarbs and chlorines we reabsorb. And we think of a lot of this reabsorption as being obligatory. And if you're obliged to buy somebody a birthday gift, what does that mean? You gotta do it, right? Okay, so the kidney is obliged to take back in about 60 to 70% of the sodium present in the PCT. And then, of course, glucose, chlorine, bicarb follow because sodium's the ringleader. I do want to mention that glucose has what's called a transport maximum. And that means that you can only reclaim about 180 units of glucose per deciliter of blood. There are only 180 channels for glucose, no more. So let's say that your blood sugar level is 300. You filter all 300 units of glucose into your PCT. How much of that glucose can you reclaim back into your bloodstream? 180, that's all you can take. If your blood sugar is 300, that means those remaining 120 units stay in your tubule system. And where does that glucose end up getting dumped?
In the urine.
In the urine, yeah. What disorder does this sound like?
Diabetes.
You got it, diabetes. So the case of this is you've got an osmotic diuretic situation set up. What does water always like to follow?
Salt and sugar.
Salt, yeah, now we know it's sugar, right? So if you've got excess sugar sitting in this tubule system, instead of being reabsorbed back into the bloodstream, the water follows the sugar, stays in the tubule system, and leaves by way of our kidneys. So this sounds like a great setup for polyuria, which is followed by polydipsia. And if you're peeing out your glucose, then you're losing your sugars and polyphagia occurs. Three classic signs of diabetes, right? Okay, so now we can kind of understand why excess sugar in the urine leads to those three cardinal symptoms or signs of diabetes. Let's see, bicarbonate is also an important one here. We're looking at bicarbs helping us to adjust blood pH and water and amino acids. There's a story we need to talk about concerning bicarbonates, and I'd like to pick back up and review this stuff with you on Thursday. So why don't we pause here? We'll come back to this, repeat it, and pick up the story for Thursday.